Find out what's on in our city on ORFM's Dunedin Community Notice Board. Go to oar.org.nz and look for the link. You're one click away from up-to-date community event listings, and you can post your own notices free of charge.
This programme was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
And our guest tonight is Amadeo Rinquez Ballesteros, who is a local celebrity science communicator here at the Otago Museum and well known to all the cool school kids around town and the teachers as well, I suspect. Now, but first I'm going to have my number of the week. And Sam last week challenged me to find something positive, which I did. And it was difficult, much more difficult than we would want. But we should be seeing lots of positive stories, but we're not there yet as a species. So we need to work harder given some positive stories. But anyway, my numbers of the week, because I got two, are 3 and 20. So in Mumbai in India, there was a beach called Versova Beach. And to say it was polluted with plastic is an understatement. It was literally covered in plastic and rubbish and looked like a literally looked like a rubbish dump. So a local lawyer, Afroz Shah, organized a volunteer cleanup off the beach in 2015. And after 3 years of hard work, they've not only cleaned up the beach, they've successfully seen 80 baby Olive Ridley turtles hatch for the first time in 20 years. And so on the afternoon of March, 23rd of March, a handful of volunteers who were working with the Versova Beach cleanup team were among the lucky few that saw the turtles on the beach and escorted them safely out to the Arabian Sea, which is where the beach flows onto. So the volunteers counted about 80 Olive Ridley turtle hatchlings. So an ecstatic Afroz Shah told Mumbai Mirror that it was an historic day for the city and no one can believe that Olive Ridley turtles can nest and hatch in Mumbai. And that too, and also at Versova Beach, especially as Versova Beach, and it's still not sunk in. So Afroz Shah has been leading a dedicated team of volunteers, which has for more than 3 years diligently cleaned up the Versova Beach every weekend and have completed over 125 weeks of marine litter cleanup and removed a staggering 5,000 tons of garbage from the beach. So Afroz Shah further said that nature's gift to us, this is nature's gift to us, the turtles. It also means that our responsibilities increase. So we need a proper marine conservation centre. So it looks like he's got his next project lined up, and that's pretty amazing. So that's my good news story for the week. It's 3 and 20, so 3 years cleaning up a beach and resulting in turtles nesting for the first time in 20 years on the said beach and reproducing and sending them little baby turtles off into the Arabian Sea to have little adventures. And that's my number of the week. So, did you have a thought for the week, Sam?
I did have a thought for the week, but I've just changed it. I did that last week about because of your number, and I'm changing it this week because of your number, and I'd just like to congratulate you on finding a positive number.
Oh, thank you so much. That was hard work.
I do think it's important, as we talked about last week, that we manage to find a positive spin and don't just forever be presenting the polar bear on the shrinking ice floe.
Okay, I shall carry on my finding my positive stories.
And, that doesn't mean we have to be blinkered. It doesn't mean we have to be ignoring everything that's going on. But we want to be finding the things that we are doing that are making a difference.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to have a word from our sponsor.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
So our guest tonight is Amadeo Enriquez Ballesteros, who is a Discovery World Coordinator at Otago Museum. So welcome to our show.
Hello, thank you.
Okay, Amadeo, where are you from? Because that's not...
No, yeah, I've got an accent. I always play around with finding out where people think I'm from, and I get told all sorts of things. I do always say I'm just from the other side of the world, and kids say, oh, you're from Antarctica. I've been... in many countries that way, but no, I come from Spain.
And what part of Spain? What part of Spain?
Madrid.
Okay. And what was it like growing up in Madrid?
Wow. Well, I loved it. It's a city that I really like to spend time in, and whenever I go back, I love it. Big city, obviously, a lot going on. And that, in a way, helped me. I think if I had been in a place with less offers, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now in life. I liked it. I like being in a city with a lot to offer. And funnily enough, that's what I think Dunedin is, even though it's a lot smaller.
All right, so tell us that story a bit. So obviously you went to school. What was it like going to school in Spain?
That was, for me, that was the issue. I wasn't really one of those kids that liked going to school. I hated it. I didn't like the education system from very early ages. It just didn't go with me. And still now, I think in Spain, things need to change a lot more. Here in New Zealand, I've liked being part of the education system. It's a lot more practical in a way. The theory, like my science, I've always liked science, but not particularly in school. And it's kind of a shame to say, but yeah, I always chose to do science all throughout high school. But my first lab to do real science in was when I came to university here. So I never really spent much practical time. My science class was with textbooks doing theory, and that kind of killed it for me.
So how come you knew you liked it?
Because of all the other things that Madrid had to offer, like going to the Natural History Museum, the Planetarium. I lived right in the middle of the city, and... Fortunately, or unfortunately, the Natural History Museum was in the way to school. So when I walked to school many times, I wouldn't go to school. I just hopped in if something was on or talks at the university. My mom taught at the university, so I was quite engaged with all the talks. If an astronaut came to Madrid, I'd be there. If there were field trips to go rock hunting or... with the geology department at the university, I'd be always doing things with scientists, but not in school. In school, the offers weren't as attractive. So I enjoyed science outside school, not so much.
So school was like, was it just basically sitting at the desk and just learning by rote and that really old school?
That's right, yeah. I mean, recently, it's maybe 2 or 3 years ago that I went back to the school I went to. And they are still using chalk, so it's a blackboard, and it's just like really old-fashioned. And it's not because of the school; that's the education system, especially now in Spain. Unfortunately, I mean, I did go to a few schools last year when I visited, and the things are changing. There was a lab in another school, not in the one that I used to go to, but there is more practical work and labs being put in place for kids to enjoy science that way too. But, you know, I think education-wise, I found my place here in New Zealand.
So why is it so traditional or kind of like, you know, old-fashioned in Spain? Is there a particular reason?
I think it's just not a priority. I mean, we complain here in New Zealand about where the money goes in politics, I mean, Spain education is really not a priority. So there's no money going into it. There's no resources. There's nothing. There's very little that I see put in place.
But it's a country that's so full of culture. I mean, so many art and
it's funny you say that because I that's what I did really well in school. I was really good at art, at history, all the humanities side of things. And teachers used to say that I kept choosing science in school, and teachers kept saying, why do you choose science? Just like choose art and history, you're going to do better at it. And that was my fight, really. So when it came to actually go to university, I knew that I wasn't going to go to university in Spain, because I just didn't want to be part of that system. And so I initially wanted to go to England. It's not too far. And I thought, well, I'll try a few universities. I went to London and saw what London had to offer. I loved it. I loved London. But my choice in the end was Southampton. I was going to do oceanography in Southampton. And I had all the paperwork ready to go. I had all the applications done. And then I remember in summer in Spain is August, I came up with the idea of why not coming a bit further. And Australia and New Zealand seemed like a good adventure to have. And because I could start here and then continue there, I thought, oh, I might as well just come here for a year and see what happens. So I came for a year, and it's actually been 20 almost now. Came in 1999.
Wow. And what subjects did you pick? And why Dunedin? Why Otago?
Oh, I guess it could have been any other. I remember checking the University of Auckland and Wellington. I remember Sydney. But in Dunedin, I knew people. My mom teaches at the university in Madrid. Mm-hmm. And she teaches along with a lot of people in London. And some of the... Well, a good friend of my mom that used to have connections in London was at the Otago University in the textiles department, Rachel Lane. The textile department apparently is not there.
No, that's not there anymore. Yeah. Yes.
But yeah, which is a shame. But that's really the first connection. When I remember when I was a kid, she a number of times came to Spain and spent holidays with us. And they saw how much I liked science in the holidays. I've always wondered how my mom coped with me, because I liked science so much, I did documentaries of it. So I had a camera, and I used to record, take photos, and do documentaries, nature documentaries. So wherever we went, I'd be up recording the sunset, or if it rained and whatever animal came out, I'd be recording it. And so I was really engaged with nature. And of course, New Zealand has a lot to offer in the field of nature. So when she came back, she constantly kept sending me magazines and things that her husband used to be the chairman of NIWA. So I remember getting like reports of NIWA studies, and I just thought New Zealand was the best place since I was a kid. So when it came to choosing where to come, I thought, hey, Otago University seems like a good place here. So I studied geology at Otago. And then a bit of paleontology. I took film. To me, the point of doing geology was just understanding where we come from. And paleontology, obviously, was to give me that answer. Never because I thought I'd become a geologist or a paleontologist. I was... In my mind, I wanted to be like a filmmaker, a National Geographic cameraman or something like that, and do documentaries about science and the natural world.
So, but,
then that didn't happen. The Otago Museum came in the way. I volunteered there while I was studying, and I discovered that I really like the audience being right there. When you make a documentary, you're not so much with an audience that you see. At the museum, suddenly I thought, wow, you can do shows, you can do same thing, storytelling, science, but with an audience right there. And that was the breakthrough. Then I thought, yes, that's what I'm going to do.
So it was really theatre that you wanted, rather than movies, the films.
Filmmaking is still a passion of mine. Science communication is a department now, but it didn't exist when I came here, so I took science, science degree, but I checked in some film making into it. And that wasn't enough at the end of it all. After doing paleontology and so on, I was incredibly frustrated with... I had started working at the museum, but I didn't quite understand the education system here. So I went to teacher's college and became a teacher. So that kind of allowed me to then, I think, do better science communication in connection with the education system.
So where did this desire to film and to record and document and like kind of tell a story, where did that come from?
I'm not sure. Well, I mean, living in a city, I remember spending time in the museums, in the planetarium, in all that the city has to offer in Madrid. And then in the weekends, going to the mountains too. But my way of getting out was either in the summer holidays when we were in our holiday home and we were in nature, or maybe the weekends. But filmmaking to me was a good way to actually make it a Monday to Friday job as well, just to get out there, travel and engage with nature and record and show. To me, I've always wanted to share the beauty of life. You were speaking before about being positive. To me, that's been a huge thing all the way through life. There's so much going on in the world, and I think we do have to focus on the good stuff and hold on to it and share that so that more people can do that, and then the world can be a better place. So I think filmmaking for me was a way to share the good stuff and get other people to do the same, kind of promote that. And yeah.
So you became a teacher. Yeah. And what schools did you teach at?
I did a few years at John McGlashan here in Dunedin. Mm-hmm. Mostly my two subjects, this was secondary teaching, so Spanish and science. And Spanish at John McGlashan, when I started teaching, was only a senior subject, so year 12, 13, which I enjoyed. But the possibility of starting it at year 9 came up at Kavanagh College. This is now like 2012, so many years ago. That's when I started. 2012 is when I changed to Kavanagh College. And I started teaching Spanish from year 9 there, so 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. That possibility of doing so much with Spanish made it for me, and I've really enjoyed the school. I'm not teaching as much now because at the museum, you know, we opened the new science center, Tuhura. That took me off teaching a little bit last year. But it's in my mind as something that, well, I might go back to because I really enjoyed it, yes.
So while you're teaching, you managed to keep your foot on the door at the museum?
Yeah, or the other way around almost, because the museum's been taking more time. I did teach full-time a couple of years and just did a little bit of museum, but mostly it's been the opposite. I've done a lot of museum and a little bit of teaching. That, to me, that would be the perfect mix.
So what is it you do at the museum now?
So my role has changed since the Science Center opened, the new Science Center, Tuhura, because I used to spend a lot of time in the museum, in Discovery World. Before Tuhura, there was Discovery World, and my job there was to do science shows, to engage people with science, doing what I like in the museum. So there was a little space in Discovery World where we did shows, but that went when we designed the new science center so that we could put more exhibits. There's no space. Now we've made one, which it means it's going to start again. I'm going to start doing shows at the museum again, actually. And my first one is tomorrow. So tomorrow,
that's exciting.
Yeah. So at 12 o'clock tomorrow, I'm going to start again the idea of doing science shows at the museum. And we'll be using the Barclay Theater for that. But yeah, there's no space in within the Science Center, as for now, in where to do shows. And so my role now is on outreach. I go to schools, I do events. So I kind of take the museum to places. And I quite like that. My highlight this year has been, about a month ago, we went to Parliament, and I blew up a big liquid nitrogen volcano in the entrance of Parliament in Wellington. That's just like crazy. I can't believe they let us do that. It was amazing. Yeah.
So your people will recognize what you do for people from around Dunedin, mm-hmm. Because you go to all of the shows and things, all of the field days, those sorts of mm-hmm. things, and amongst other things, blow things up.
Yeah. That's what people want me to do, so I go for it. Yeah.
What's the science learning from that? Like, it's not just entertainment. Interestingly, you share the space with a magician.
Yeah. I do like to work with Jonathan a lot, and there's that you've just added a huge conversation, because there's two things there. One is the showness of it all and how fun science is then, and whether I just do it for fun or not. And there's a lot to it, because It's not just fun. There's a level of engagement that you need to have with science for it to be there in your life, and that's what I think I'm trying to do. But also the whole magic connection there. So there's two conversations. I'm going to go for both. But the magic one is important too, because a lot of what I do, especially little kids that see it as magic because they don't understand what it is, and I say science, magic and science to me is the same thing. It's just that with science you get to understand what's happening. With magic, it's magic. You just don't think about it, but it's the same thing. So I think allowing people to understand that things that you don't understand and are magical, and I could go as far as starting to think about religions and things that we don't want to understand because they are better not understood. Well, science can help us understand them, and why not? Like, to me, the Big Bang, the story, the history of the universe is the most incredible story. And yeah, and you can think it's magical, or you can just through science try and find out what we can. And to me, that's important. So yeah, that connection to magic, I think, is really valuable. And I grab it whenever I can, and I play around with the idea of, hey, what I've just done is magic or science, depending on what you want out of it. Yeah. So that's the magic connection. What was the other one?
The level of engagement.
The level of engagement. And wow, that is huge, because going back to the education system and maybe thinking about the theme of your program, sustainability. I mean, the world is in a really bad place at the moment. We really need to change the way we are doing things. And I think we are starting to do so in a way where we can make the world a better place. The new generations are aware of it. There's technology that will allow things to happen, and it's just a matter of time. But we do need to change some of the things we've been doing the wrong way for a long time, and education is one of them. I mean, the way we are educating kids makes sense in a world with the Industrial Revolution, where you are training kids to become a particular thing. That's long gone now. I mean, we have technology that will do a lot of the jobs that humans do now. In 20 years, in 50 years, we don't even know what jobs are going to be there. So training kids' skills and things they need to know for a particular job is really a waste of time. I think we need to shift the training of skills to actually really training kids to be good people, to know what the world needs, and then you learn skills. And whatever the job you do in the future, you will learn the skills for it. But it's much more important to really be a good human being, to make the world a better place. So with that in mind, I can then focus on science and the way we teach science. And I have huge issues with it, because especially when you come to the senior level of science, not only we focus a lot in facts, which are important to know, and in skills, which are important to learn. But again, I think we are forgetting about something really important, which is the way you feel, the engagement with what you are studying. So science is being taught to be the scientific method. And obviously, scientific method starts with a question. You give a question, you have a hypothesis, you do an experiment, that's the scientific method. But we are missing something really big, which is before the question. You have to have a bit of passion for that question. Otherwise, don't even care. If it's not relevant, then that question doesn't matter. And that's unfortunately what's happening to a lot of kids. They are being thrown questions which they have to study, and they do not care about that question. So Einstein actually once got asked by Hadamard, a French mathematician, I think it was 1945 or something like that, I don't know. He Hadamard interviewed Einstein, and one of his questions, I read this in a book where the whole interview had been written, and it really grabbed me that one of his questions to Einstein was, how would you describe the process of discovery? Obviously, through science. How did Einstein come up with E equals MC squared? How do you discover things? well, we would say the scientific method, if you want to do science. But that's not what that's not what Einstein answered. It wasn't about the scientific method. Before the scientific method, Einstein felt. He felt the first thing, I mean, he speaks about dreaming and feeling. Obviously, you have to have a level of understanding on the field that you are researching. But if you want to discover, logic is not the first thing you need. If you do logical things, you're not going to discover something that hasn't been discovered. You just have to go with it. He felt it. He felt whatever he was going through, and he did this. In his answer, he said that you first feel, and then you explain through logic what you've felt, and that to me was amazing, because we need to make people feel, and then go through logic. And that's really what I try to do with my shows and engagement. Just grab their emotions first and then go into logic.
Yeah, I think because often in stories or like films or popular fiction, scientists are portrayed as being these very very logical, Mr. Spock kind of figures who are divorced from emotion. Yeah. But when you think about the great science communicators and great scientists, like people like David Suzuki and David Attenborough and what was that the British guy who used to do the Sky at Night with big eyebrows. I can't remember his name. He was a famous astronomer, but he was always very, very passionate. Always reminds me that it's the passion and the emotion that they put into telling the story that really communicated that. And you felt that they really, really had a deeper connection than just like this cold connection. And is that that's what drives you, yeah?
Totally, yeah. I think, I mean, that has to be, I almost think that has to be a requirement of anyone teaching science, because otherwise you lose it. And it's a shame to see kids and adults actually saying things like, science is not for me, because they don't connect with it. And really, I mean, if science wasn't for you, you'd be dead. So science is for everyone at many different levels. Obviously, not everyone's going to become an academic at university doing science, but everyone is a scientist when you're cooking in the kitchen. Everyone's a scientist when you're taking care of your pet, when you're doing gardening, when you're taking care of yourself. That is all science. And it's a shame that we think science is only for scientists at the university, because it is not. And just realizing that it's everywhere is important.
And that was Patrick Moore that Sam helpfully looked up for me.
Oh, good.
Patrick Moore, yes. I always remember watching that late at night. I would stay up with my granddad and watch Patrick Moore's Sky at Night with him.
Yeah.
And just be amazed with all these things that were discovered about the universe and about the stars. And he was just this passionate old man, but it was great. And so one of the things that like strikes me about the education systems is often you learn facts, and the facts are either right or wrong, and you have to learn by rote, but that's not the scientific, and certainly not something that we discover in sustainability, because one of the problems with sustainability is, like, often, and we've talked about this a lot, there are no right or wrong answers. In fact, there's a lot of very, very difficult problems, some of which we can't solve. And this often, we come back to this theme quite a lot in our education when we're talking about sustainability education. It's the fact that it just throws people off, especially engineers and physicists, people who have like very rigid educations. It really throws them. How do we then start educating our youth about understanding that, for sustainability and for the problems we face, may not be any comfortable solutions, or maybe some really difficult choices.
Yeah, I mean, but to me, that is the focus, is what do you want to achieve? Not give them... There's a place in Northeast Valley here that I adore. It's called Tinker School. And it's a place where they do, at the moment, holiday programs, but it could certainly become a school on its own with its own way of approaching the school curriculum. And I love it, because kids go there and decide what to do. Maybe they want to make a table. Maybe they want to do something. And they have all the resources they would want. There's a workshop there. There's a room where they have computers to do the research. There's all sorts of things. And once they have a project, they learn. because they want to do that project. And maybe your project is to protect or fix some problem that we've done on Earth. That is the goal. And then you will need some science, you will need some English, you will need some math, you will need to, for that goal. So they are all working. It's like, what do I need to learn to make a car? And then you know the engineering, the physics, the everything. Then it comes, and you learn all the subjects in the context of what we need to do, not the other way around, which is how schools work. It's like, yeah, now you go to science, you learn all this, and one day you'll put it together. It'll be useful one day. But how ridiculous is that? I mean, it could be useful right now for what you want to do. I think that's a much better approach in education. So you get a project, and you learn things that you need, and it's all. It's art, it's history, it's everything in relation to that one task that you have. So that's the focus of Tinker School, and it's amazing because obviously there's kids that go there that are really into it. But again, that Tinker School would have worked for me as a kid because you engage and you have that passion. You want to do what you have to do, and if science is in the way, then you learn it. I think that's kind of a good idea.
Should we rebrand science as makerspace?
Yeah,
I mean, maker science.
Yeah, I mean that's how it started being, right? We've only started classifying things and breaking them down and saying this is art and this is science not that long ago, really. But we have to mix them again. It's a big mistake to break them into different things.
How do you deal with the complexity of a story? Something that's really big and complex, and go for climate change.
Yeah.
Do you break it down? What's the process you go through to think, how can I engage kids in this?
Yeah, I go really basic in the... I mean, climate change is huge. So, yeah, I'd go for a story that is a lot more focused, say... a penguin. And then through the penguin, you see what's happening to climate change and, yeah, melting ice and so on. Again, without trying to tell everything, but just whatever the penguin encounters, and there'll be really big topics said there. So I think in storytelling, you need a character that you can relate to, and through that character, then you can learn everything. And that's something important in the context of a classroom as well. Sometimes, I mean, chemistry was one of my biggest issues in school at the time. I mean, the periodic table, I found it so hard to connect with. And I wish they had done something that I discovered when I was here in Dunedin again. And it was at the observatory that I got explained how the elements come to be, the story of the elements. Hydrogen is what the stars are made up of. The sun right now is fusing hydrogen, and when hydrogen fuses, you get helium, the next element in the periodic table. And so it goes. All the elements of the periodic table are made in the stars. It's the story of a star. It's not, here's the periodic table, learn the elements of the periodic table, and where's the story? Give me a story. The story is actually the story of the universe. That's chemistry. I would have studied chemistry, I think, instead of geology, if I had been told that in school. But no one told me a story about the periodic table. I remember buying books about the periodic table, and they gave me facts of each element, and it was interesting, but I always was missing a story. And it's the story of a star. That's what describes the periodic table. The story of a penguin could go for climate change. There's always a story, and that's going to help understand the concepts a lot better, and you'll remember them for the rest of your life. Whereas learning the periodic table just as a list of elements is just not good enough.
I talked before about the iconic image of the polar bear on the on the ice floe. That polar bear doesn't have a name. Well, maybe it did to its parents. But we don't have it characterized. It's a charismatic megafauna looking sad. Do you risk the oversimplifying it with a character, anthropomorphizing?
Yes, you do. I guess, I mean, that's a danger that can be addressed in the story itself. But I'd rather do that than not have a story, in a way, you know, and you have to speak to a particular audience. So if I'm speaking to kids, I mean, it is important to know that, yes, penguins are penguins and not humans, and their needs will be very different. But, I mean, yeah, it's still a penguin, and if you can relate to him or to it, then I think, again, you'll care more for it, and that's what we want. We want to care. So, yeah, there's a danger of oversimplifying and making animals be human-like when they shouldn't. But, yeah, I just take care not to push that too far. But still, I think a penguin can be a character with...
Do you include in the story the bad stuff? And how do you avoid kids becoming despondent that, you know, we can't solve this problem?
I do include the bad stuff, but then you give hope and solutions. I mean, in climate change, I like speaking at the moment. Last time I went to Madrid, in the public transport, I saw some hydrogen buses. And to me, that was amazing. It's like, wow, hydrogen buses. They are actually burning hydrogen. And instead of getting carbon dioxide out, they are just putting more water into the atmosphere. That's amazing. The problem at the moment is making that hydrogen available in a sustainable way. That's not really where we are at the moment. But once we solve that problem, hydrogen is an incredible fuel to use. And so, yes, we've got a huge problem with carbon dioxide. Burning fossil fuels definitely has to be on the list of never to go and use again. But we need to sort out things like, okay, so how do we make hydrogen in a sustainable way? And if you want to find out, that's what kids can do. They can be the ones going to the university or and doing some research and finding out about how to make the world a better place by using hydrogen and making hydrogen available in petrol stations. And so, yeah, I think you just need to point out that there are options and things that can be discovered.
Does it get political?
Not from my side of things. Obviously, I do address a lot that if things that haven't happened yet is because of politicians making the wrong choices. To me, one of the proudest moments of being a teacher is seeing kids that I taught choosing to be engaged with both science and politics. There's a student that is studying now physics and politics, and I thought, wow, yes, we need more politicians that are scientists to change the world. So I do address that. I do address that. Unfortunately, the people in power in the world are not very knowledgeable scientists, and I think that's a big problem. So, yeah, that's part of the story, the effect that bad politics have in making good choices.
Do you have shows that include controversial topics? 1080, fluoride, genetics?
Oh, wow. You know, today I went to the Mount Grant water treatment plant because, this was mostly related to a science fair project that I'm kind of mentoring through, and it is about fluoride. Definitely I want to tackle big issues and even if it's not definitely in a show, I like to bring those things up, but also in programs that are more focused, like science fair. Let's do a science fair about light pollution in Dunedin. Let's do a science fair about fluoride in water and really find out the science. With fluoride, it's going to be really hard because there are scientists that go for either, yes, it's good, and it's a 50-50 breakup there. So who do you go for? Is it actually a good idea or a bad idea? But just finding out the science of it. Definitely, controversial topics are definitely needed to be tackled through science at every level. I don't think it's kind of just for adults. Kids need to know. So
you said you had your barrel of water at the steps of Parliament or on the Parliament grounds.
Yeah.
What were you doing there?
We've had Lab in a Box, which is Curious Minds grant that got given to the university, and the Otago Museum helped those programs run last year. It's been going for a couple of years now. So Lab in a Box is a shipping container that got transformed into a lab, and it gets taken mostly to rural schools that have no science labs, and so teachers can use that Lab in a Box to run programs on science. And we covered the whole South Island for the last couple of years, and the second half of last year it went and toured around the North Island with people from Victoria University, and so we kind of handed them everything. And when they finished the tour in Wellington, the last session was in front of Parliament, and we thought it would be cool to go and just finish it with a big bang, literally. So that was it. We were just finishing the tour of Lab in a Box in the North Island. Now it's back. It was in Queenstown last week, and it's going to be in the Farmer's Market on Saturday this weekend, so you can see Lab in a Box there.
What did the politicians say or ask?
Oh, they loved it. I mean, we had a lot of really good feedback. So we are now hoping to get some more funding for it, because that's a big problem. The funding sometimes is not there for these kind of things. So it was nice to be able to show them at their doorstep what Lab in a Box is about. And we will keep trying to get more and more funding so that we can take it places. Yeah, so that was the reason of going to Wellington with a show in Parliament.
What's your favourite show?
One that I always like telling. I've done it a lot in Dunedin, so I'm thinking of new things now, but that periodic table, that connection with the universe, that knowing that we are stardust and understanding that all the atoms that we have in our body are the same atoms that stars are made up of and the universe is made up of. We're just lucky that we can think about it, but really we are stardust, thinking about stardust, and using hydrogen to explain the difference between just burning hydrogen and the fusion that goes in stars. And so that story, that to me, that's the story. If I had thought twice or about it before studying, I think I would have studied physics or astrophysics instead of paleontology. Because when I chose to study geology and paleontology, I really wanted to just answer those questions. Where do we come from? And paleontology didn't really tell me that. Astronomy did. The stars, astrophysics. So to me, that's one of my favorite shows to go through. Telling that story with demonstrations that include hydrogen and so on.
Which you set fire to?
Yes. Yeah. We did that in Parliament too. We had some of the members of Parliament holding fire. That was cool. Yeah.
Have you hurt anyone?
No. Funnily enough, no.
How much sort of management do you have to do of the crowd, the kids?
I mean, for what? The fire one in particular? It depends on the demonstration, but... We health and safety this year and these days is important, so we do have a lot of paperwork. That's my office hours at the museum, is filling up health and safety sheets and making sure that everything is in place. And yeah, I've never really had accidents, touch wood, but yeah.
When you drop the dry ice, what is it that you put in the barrel of water?
Liquid nitrogen.
Liquid nitrogen. What's the limiting factor on how high and big a boom you can make? Could put more in and it would be bigger.
Yeah, it has gone wrong. I mean, when I started doing that, yes, we had accidents, but no one got hurt in where the actual barrel exploded and the water went everywhere and the plastic went everywhere. And so the thickness of the plastic I found in the chemistry department, Dave Warren does it with a metallic one, which is cool, a metallic barrel that's not going to break as easily as the plastic one. But the one I used in Parliament was metallic, actually, but it got all deformed. So it wasn't round by the end of it. It was just this weird barrel, weird shaped. So just trying that. And then the bottles as well. I found that Coke bottles are perfect. Just keep a lot of pressure in it and then blows up. If you use other bottles, probably the most dangerous thing happening was once I put the liquid nitrogen in the bottle and it did not blow up. So we waited about 10 minutes. All the liquid nitrogen turned into gas in the bottle. That means the bottle gets really big, and it could blow up any time. If you hold that bottle, you could lose your hand if you're holding it. So there's no way. If the bottle doesn't blow up, you cannot touch it. You leave it there. So I actually left it there and carried on with the show. And when I finished the show, this was part of the health and safety planning. And it's only happened once, but I had to grab a really long stick with a nail. I poured the barrel of water. The bottle was there. It could blow up any time. And I just hit the... It was like a bomb. It sounded so incredibly loud. And I just hit the bottle and it exploded. So it's just having those things in mind. When I plan an experiment, I think, what's the worst thing that can happen? And I write what I would do if that actual worst thing happens. Yeah. So with hydrogen, I mean, the worst thing that can happen is that I drop the hydrogen and the actual hydrogen cylinder becomes a rocket. That happened once in South Dunedin, and it went through a wall, so it could kill someone. I'm playing with fire there in that it is dangerous. But then, okay, so what do I do with the cylinder in case it becomes a rocket? It's always pointing up, so it goes up and not to someone. And so all those things are in my mind. And yeah,
it's the worst thing that could happen, aside from the people getting hurt, is that people weren't engaged. But
wow,
you managed to pull that off.
Right. Yeah, but that, I just let myself feel things. I think that's the trick. As soon as I'm having fun, that kind of goes and spreads. So, yeah, I do all the paperwork, all the preparation, but when it comes to doing the show, I actually forget about the script. I forget about everything. I just let myself feel and hope that people come on board with me. So, yeah, I think that's my way to go.
And the coolest thing I've seen in a long time is a video you put on Facebook.
Right.
A couple of weeks ago when you were disposing of some excess liquid nitrogen and you let it go in your motel room.
That was in the science festival in Nelson, yeah. I had some dry ice left. This was dry ice. Liquid nitrogen, yeah. And we were going to go to the airport. Like, we had half an hour. I had to get rid of it. So I boiled the kettle, and if you put dry ice in water, you get a bit of a cloud. I had a bit too much dry ice, I guess, because I boiled the kettle. I put boiled water, and the room just... I opened the window, health and safety again. I was thinking we need a bit of an airflow. So, yeah, I opened the window. I opened the bathroom, and there was an airflow. But the window, the window was halfway through. So below the window, the whole room was a cloud of carbon dioxide. It was incredible. It just looked amazing. It's like a horror film with cloud effects. And my partner was in bed just waking up. She woke up on the cloud. It was like, what's happening here? It was quite funny. Yeah, so I had to post it. It was funny.
It was. Are you still learning?
I always learn. I'm never going to finish. It's funny. That's, speaking about the education system and teaching, I think that's something else that really needs to be taken on board, is learning. It's not only for the students. Teachers have to learn from students too, and that's happening all the time for me. So, yeah.
Okay, some questions to end with. Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
I mean, I've never thought about that one, but I'm going to make up one right now. to me, sustainability is really living in a world that is self-sufficient, that we are not actually breaking down and degrading, which is what we've been doing for a long time now. And now we know that, and we know how to get there. We just need to do it. We need to, a bit like in Tinker School, that's our goal. What do we do to get there? From not burning fossil fuels to the way we grow our food, everything is part of that world that we need to make balance. It's a balanced world. I hate to think humans are kind of pests of Earth that will totally mess it up to the point where we will just die. There's always going to be animals that will make it through. But yeah, to me, it's amazing to think, or amazing and scary to think, that 60 million years ago, dinosaurs went extinct. The asteroid kind of just made it happen even faster. Dinosaurs were already dying because of the oxygen level in the atmosphere going down. So That was an extinction. It's exactly what's happening now. So we have another major extinction happening right now. And we can maybe make a difference. Not that maybe some animals won't die, but we know since the Industrial Revolution, going back to that, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has skyrocketed like no other time in the history of our civilization. So we need to take care of that, and then we'll have a sustainable world.
Do you think the kids coming through school get it?
This is sad because I don't think so. It just depends so much on teachers, on the way that they are sitting. Just like I see kids that think science is not for me, I do see kids and adults as well saying, well, whatever I do is not going to really make much of a difference. So why would I care, kind of thing? Like, if politicians are doing it wrong, what can I do? And it's a shame because, yeah, if we all did a little bit, we could make big, big differences in the world. And that just kind of flows through to, again, politicians and everyone taking good decisions. So I don't think everyone gets it because a lot of kids, I mean, I've taught classes in where I speak about climate change, and some kids go, oh, not again. Oh, come on. I don't care about this. So the attitude is not always ideal, and we need those stories. We need that emotional engagement for everyone to get it, because kids are not being taught that way. There is a lot of, people that just think it's not for them and they're not going to make a difference, so why would they care?
Because it's just occurred to me that you're in the fortunate and perhaps unique position of perhaps having taught most kids in Otago.
Right.
Because everyone does a trip to the museum.
Yeah, and if not, I take it to them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, so
no pressure.
And it's not me. I work in a team now, so there's a lot of people doing what I do at the museum too. And, we have a huge responsibility. But to me, the biggest responsibility is to be able to pass on all this way of teaching to other teachers, to adults, to parents, so that it can trigger further behaviors that won't just stay in the classroom. Okay. Which is what happens.
Yeah. That was only one of my questions, so we're going to have to wriggle. What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Biggest success? I was thinking about those students that, like, whenever I see students that have chosen to do something that really is a positive, I've seen that with a lot, to see kids making right choices, and when it comes to choosing what they want to do in life and so on, is amazing that after having a bit of an input to their lives, they choose to do something meaningful, and to me that's amazing.
We're writing a book about these conversations, as Shane said. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. So what's your superpower?
My superpower?
Not an imaginary superpower, an actual superpower.
So what I do is emotionally engage people with what I do, I guess. And emotionally feel for absolutely everything, which sometimes hurts. But that's what I can do well.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yeah, I think so. I'm action-based. I'm always doing stuff, yeah.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
I think what really what I want to do is offer what I would have wanted when I was a kid to kids in particular, and seeing that I can do it, and seeing that kids are actually getting it, That motivates me. I do it one day and I want to do it again and again and again and again. And I don't think I'm ever going to stop working until I die, because that's what I love doing.
What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Oh, reach further. So I was in the museum now. As part of Outreach, I am happy to be moving a lot around Otago. But, I mean, we went to Wellington. We've been in Nelson. I think nationally, I think I'd like to grow. And from there, I just want to, I mean, you know, my dream of doing documentaries now is kind of, I want a TV program, something that really reaches a lot of people. That, to me, would be amazing. I like having small groups. I like teaching a class. I like a small grouping where you can really engage. But I think it's important that more people get it. And that's only done through further growth nationally, internationally. That's, I think, where I'd like to go.
Okay, two questions quickly. If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
Wow. So just, if I could stop all the issues that we have, I mean, just give me the way to put hydrogen in place instead of fossil fuels and stop carbon dioxide messing up the planet. That to me, if I had to choose one thing, that would be a start, yeah.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Don't stop feeling life, everything you do. Yeah. Look, just do logic after you've felt something. Otherwise, life is worthless.
Awesome. You're listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM. This show was recorded on the 26th of April, 2018. Our guest was Amadeo Enriquez Ballesteros. Your host, Professor Samuel Mann, and me, Shane Gallagher. You can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe on iTunes or on oir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Find out what's on in our city on ORFM's Dunedin Community Notice Board. Go to oar.org.nz and look for the link. You're one click away from up-to-date community event listings, and you can post your own notices free of charge.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.